Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Chris Hutton. Chris, how are you?
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm doing well, thank you. Anxiously following various sources, trying to see what's coming down the line, as I'm sure we all are. Hopefully, you can give me some oracle-like insights, you and Sarah, too.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that in a minute. And also, we're joined today by Sarah Gon. Sarah, how are you doing?
I'm just concerned that whatever's coming down the line is going to hit me in the back of the head.
Yeah. So we are still in the purgatory, the limbo, known as the Government of National Unity negotiations, which continue to drag on without any clear resolution in sight. Ramaphosa seems to be trying to set some kind of deadline for Thursday, I think either next week or the week after. Look, honestly, all of these things are movable, so, you know, who knows? But it does seem as though things will probably come to a head soon. There was some speculation that maybe today things might come to a head. As of 1:30, as we're recording this or putting this out live, there doesn't seem to have been much movement. It is interesting, though, that after all the doom and gloom about the Government of National Unity negotiations yesterday, with these kind of letters going between the two sides, particularly Ramaphosa's one accusing the DA of being treason, of you know, undermining the constitution, and it's trying to set up a parallel government and all sorts of nonsense like that. Today, Fikile Mbalula, who has actually, in many ways, to my surprise, been a bit of a voice of moderation in all of this stuff, has said that the government is close to forming a government of national unity, and that the negotiations are going well again. So who knows? The Rand and the nervous day traders immediately boosted the Rand by 1.6%, which is kind of interesting. The Rand has been really having a schizophrenic week, going up and down, as it seems, all over the place. Just another thing to remark, while all of this goes on, the problems of the country continue. Of course, we've talked this week about the ridiculously high unemployment rate, particularly in places like the Eastern Cape and Northwest, where the unemployed now outnumber the employed. But currently, large parts of Joburg are once again without water due to this time planned maintenance rather than unplanned maintenance at some of the major pumping stations. It's also not entirely clear when all of this will be restored. The pumping stations are supposed to be pumping now at 80% of capacity. But once again, we are sitting in a situation that makes life rather difficult, which was not what I expected after the election. I kind of thought to myself, I said on the show that, you know, I was wondering whether load shedding was going to come back the day after the election. And to my surprise and delight, it didn't. Although now it seems to have water shedding. So I'm not so sure. I'm terribly pleased by all that. But anyway, let's get into the Government of National Unity details. So, of course, the big news yesterday was that there was this letter from President Cyril Ramaphosa to John Steenhuisen, which, as I said, accused the DA of trying to set up a parallel government and was very aggressive. It accused Helen Zille of having a nasty tone when writing the previous letter to the ANC. Of course, what he doesn't mention is the letter that Helen Zille wrote to the ANC, talking about 10 or 11 cabinet posts, was in response to the ANC's initial offer, which was 3 cabinet posts. The DA, through one of its negotiators, Tony Leon, who wrote a column on this stuff titled "The ANC Faces Its Own Sophie's Choice," talked about how, according to the agreement that was signed between the two parties, the statement of intent, which, as Leon suggests, the ANC appears to have decided that it doesn't really have to follow anything in, the DA feels it's entitled to around 10 cabinet positions, the ANC, I think, 17, the IFP, 3, the PA, 1, and the Freedom Front plus 1. Sorry, 17 for the ANC, 9 for the DA, 2 for the IFP, 1 for the PA, and 1 for the Freedom Front plus. PAC and Good would not obtain entry to cabinet if this was based on how much of the vote you got in national parliament. He said, however, the DA was willing to give up at least a couple of seats, and it seems as though they did agree to an offer from Ramaphosa on Wednesday night, that they would get 6 cabinet posts, a number of deputy ministerial posts, and also the position of trade, industry, and competition. However, there was pushback on the ANC MEC, particularly from Gwede Mantashe and Paul Mashatile, who basically said something along the lines of, this will destroy transformation in the country. We can't possibly let them have trade and industry. It has too much power. There's also high officials, essentially deployed cadres within the Department of Trade and Industry, who have said that the Department of Trade and Industry is at the heart of government's transformation agenda. We can't possibly hand it to a party whose policies are against critical aspects of that agenda, such as BEE and affirmative action. This kind of proves the point that the DA has made in some of these negotiations, that they need to control the appointment of director generals because the ANC has deployed so many cadres to the bureaucracy. The fact that you have anonymous officials in the Department of Trade and Industry basically saying we can't deviate from ANC policy, I think to me suggests that any semblance of non-political alignment in that department is long since gone. But Sara, let me get to you. You know, I've just laid out such a confusing, complicated mess of different parts moving all together. What do you make of where things stand at the moment? It seems like an awful lot of the leaks and statements and things are being driven by negotiating tactics and the fact that Ramaphosa and the DA, neither of whom wants to seem like they're being screwed by the other side, is trying to project strength.
I think the problem for Ramaphosa is that he more than anything is being caught, as we've previously discussed, between bringing the DA on board by making offers that the Gwede Mantashes and the Paul Mashatiles of the world then reject, being the upstanding citizens and competence that they are. So he's not a forceful enough leader to do that. I mean, he's really, as I said, defaulting to 2018, when he could really grab the nettle. But I think perhaps what we can look at is not the consequences, because I think the DA will hang there in there until it's absolutely clear that nothing's going to change. After which, I think the decision to leave would be inevitable. But I think the thing that the ANC has to bear in mind is probably twofold. The one is that its future depends on its success, its existence probably depends on going to coalition with the DA rather than the alternative. And the other is that what a business going to do if he doesn't? And let that be an issue that the ANC, NEC actually gets its head around, because if the load shedding we have not suffered is significantly or even to any extent a result of the tunandering between business and government of last year, in which it undertook to get involved in critical areas like energy, transport, and crime, then that'll crash and burn. And if you think the markets, which are not, you know, the most politically sophisticated, but they are sensitive, and that, you know, if they what do they call it, sentiment, let's call it gut reaction, I think it's fairly reflected what we've seen this week. And Sir Ramaphosa needs to make more of it. I'm not sure he will, if he's up against a guy like Mantashe. But the warning to the ANC is there, and it's, you know, we can disparage the markets, the foreigners, the Americans, whatever we like. But you know, the problem is going to be the ANC's more than anyone else's. It's got nowhere to go.
No, I think that's very much the case. It does still seem like the ANC hasn't fully comprehended that it needs to make, as we've said so often this week, some important choices here. And I think a lot of this truly is the fact that ANC internal politics continues to hold everything hostage. To some degree, I think a lot of this is because Ramaphosa wants to project real strength, and he doesn't want to look like he's being pushed around by the DA, even though he probably thinks that he does need a deal with them. Now, why is he so scared of being seen to look weak in front of the DA? Because it will give enormous fuel to anyone who wants to challenge Ramaphosa's leadership of the ANC or his faction's leadership of the ANC. The ANC is clearly, normally when you have a political leader who leads the party into an election where it loses 17% of the vote, or 17 percentage points in the vote, you're toast. Now, I think it's kind of a bit silly because, of course, Ramaphosa remains the most popular politician in the country, despite everything, even though he's much less popular than he used to be. And the ANC really doesn't have anyone to replace him. But that won't really matter necessarily, I think, in internal ANC deliberations where they'll say, look, he led us into this disastrous election. He failed to stop MK. And now, look, he's doing a deal with the enemy, the devil, the white liberals or whatever, you know, the ANC wants to call the DA. So, Chris, let me come to you. I mean, firstly, you know, what would you do if you were Ramaphosa? And secondly, do you think we're actually going to see something here? I mean, it's clear that the DA doesn't want to be seen to walk away from this because they don't want to be called like quitters or you know, overly ideological or unpractical or uncooperative. But at the same time, it's clear that they're not going to take a deal that they feel doesn't give them any real influence.
Yeah, if my focus was still party unity, as has come to typify Ramaphosa's focus throughout his presidency of the his leadership of the ANC, your longer term unity is better served in some sort of governance agreement with the DA. There's stability to government than more than there would be with a rats and mice coalition. You can, depending on your trust and your own ability and that of your colleagues, you can try and neuter the official opposition over the long term. So that helps you into 2029 and further along. If you can occupy the centrist position in South African politics where your average voter doesn't really, more extremist positions don't resonate with your average voter. So you also put yourself in that good position over the long term. So there's those considerations. And also part of all this, of course, and you've mentioned the factionalism, the ANC's next elective conference, that will be an issue, or if it isn't already at play, this is also part of these calculations. It's not just about constituting a government of national unity now, but how does the ANC set itself up, the different factions, with that the issues now with tensions and power sharing, who gets what, which candidates are put forward. Is it Fikile Mbalula versus Mantashe, Lamola, others possibly on the table? Lots of fresh blood amongst the ANC MPs in Parliament. So there could be names that we're not even yet considering. So that's all part of the calculus. But I think if you want to be somewhat still the biggest player in South African politics over the next 10 to 20 years, the best route for now is working with the DA. You can portray yourself as the mature player. You invited everyone to come to the table. Some ruled themselves out, but you've now compromised. You've worked together with the DA. I'm not saying that sells clicks necessarily, and it's that exciting. It's much more exciting to talk about tensions and ideological clashes, et cetera, et cetera. But maybe you realize that it's just both have so much at stake, the ANC and the DA. You can try and keep each other in check in some way, and then also try and still implement your policies over the medium to long term. It's arguably easier for you as the ANC to control the DA in some ways versus trying to control the MK and the EFF if they were in coalition with you. So for you and your self-interest, it's perhaps the best scenario. That might be hubris, but I think that may be part of the calculus.
So if the ANC breaks its alignment with the DA now, or if that falls apart, and the ANC has to go to the EFF in particular, I think MK is probably too chaotic for them to make any kind of deal with. But you know, I think they could make a deal with the EFF. But the problem is, apparently, the ANC initially seems to have rejected the EFF in part because the EFF's demands were too extreme. Now, if they go back to the EFF with their demands, you know, having just failed to build the alternative, the EFF will say, oh, you thought that was extreme. Wait till you see our second go at it, which is not a very pleasant prospect, I'm sure, for the ANC right now. They are, you know, not really having a great time with this. It is interesting, though, and that a lot of the DA strategy here seems to have been based on the fact that they signed the statement of intent with the ANC. Sure. Which the ANC managed to get them to do and then vote for President Ramaphosa as president. But now the ANC seems to have been said, well, you don't got no more leverage over us. So tough luck for you. I don't know. Sarah, your thoughts?
It actually comes to the point where, you know, talking about the internal leadership struggle, well, you know, there may be, you know, it may give impetus to them, to those who are opposed to Ramaphosa, to change the leadership structure. But then they're going to have the problem as to they may not be able to get their ANC president elected as president of the country. Because if the DA doesn't support it and EFF doesn't support it or whatever it may be, or MK, if the figures don't go with them, you know, that's a card that I think Ramaphosa simply can play with in order to try and fight this battle. Can you imagine how they must feel about the DA not having the sort of internecine fights that the ANC is besieged by? Whoa, that must be very annoying.
Well, it does have some internecine fights. Yeah, and you can be sure that the next DA conference, if the Government of National Unity doesn't go well, doesn't really work out, or the DA has a rough time in the next couple of years, you can be sure that their next elective conference will likewise be a bit of a bloodbath. But, you know, the journalism in general on the DA is very weak. We get lots of insights into the internal workings of the ANC all the time from the major news reporting agencies, but absolutely nothing seems to be done on like what the internal battles inside the DA are. And, you know, there are very many of those too, but they just never seem to come out into the public light. I think because up till now, South Africa's media has tended to kind of just ignore the DA in a certain sense. But I suspect that's going to change in the post-election world.
Well, to mention, up until this point for business especially and their interests, for the last 30 years to try and understand legislation and the ideology driving legislation, you've just had to try and understand the ANC. Of course, many of them tried to shirk away from the reality and they were bitten appropriately and accordingly. But now you're going to need to understand a bit more of a complicated picture. So maybe there'll be just pure capitalist incentive from the media point of view as well to give more insights into parties like the DA, the IFP, Patriotic Alliance, as you try and understand the legislative and ideological processes behind it all. So hopefully, you know, the market finds a way.
Yes. I think, as you said, Sarah, you know, the markets are not particularly politically sophisticated. I think that's very true. You know, one shouldn't be just straight up led by, you know, oh, the markets have gone down, therefore we must panic and run around with our heads on fire and reverse whatever we're doing. But at the same time, over the long term, the markets will very definitely punish you for poor decisions. And if policy stays exactly the same or gets worse, which is difficult to imagine, but still always possible under an ANC-EFF coalition, where we see, you know, sort of mass nationalization of things, we see fiddling around with the Reserve Bank, that kind of stuff, the ANC might well wish that it went into an alliance with the DA now. It's already possible we could see an alliance between the ANC and EFF if this thing falls apart. And in 2 years from now, the ANC will have to come back to the DA begging for better for more cooperation from them because of how chaotically things have gone. We'll have to see. I don't know. Sorry, do you have any final thoughts before we move on?
No, just to say that, you know, quicksand is going to be the theme of today's episode, sinking into it.
Yes, indeed. So, let us go overseas now, and we are heading towards an American presidential election. Probably going to talk a lot more about this in coming months as things shape up, but an unusual thing happened in this presidential election so far, which is that a debate was called fairly early. Now, part of the reason for that is because early voting happens in the US now quite a ways out from when the election actually happens. As a result, the sort of period in which you have to influence the electorate in American presidential elections is much shorter than it used to be. And Joe Biden's election campaign, which started off, I think, pretty much with him in the lead, has not been going well. Joe Biden has kind of slumped. He's recovered very slightly in the past couple of weeks, but he was not doing particularly well going as the campaign wore on. Trump seemed to be outmaneuvering him in a whole bunch of places in polling. Almost every single swing state had either the candidates essentially tied or Trump ahead. And it was in this context that the Joe Biden campaign team decided that it was going to call for an early presidential election. There was much talk earlier in the election cycle that Biden and Trump would refuse to debate each other. Well, Biden put out a challenge to Trump, which Trump accepted. There were conditions, no crowd, The microphones would be cut off when you weren't allowed to speak so that there wouldn't be a lot of talking over each other, as happened in 2020. And this, I think, in a lot of ways was really Joe Biden's last chance to reverse the direction of how the election had been going. His campaign had really failed to gain a lot of traction and was behind. So last night they had their debate. It was about 3 a.m. for us in South Africa. And it did not go well for Joe Biden. Even people friendly to Biden or close to him basically acknowledged the thing was a disaster for him. An analysis from CNN, which is not super hostile to Biden, said, and I'm quoting from it here, I can't remember who wrote it, but it was hosted on CNN. If Joe Biden loses November's election, history will record that it took 10 minutes to destroy a presidency. It was a clear political disaster was about to unfold as soon as the 81-year-old commander-in-chief, stiffly shuffled on the stage in Atlanta to stand 8 feet from ex-president Donald Trump at what may turn out to be the most fateful presidential debate in history. Objectively, Biden produced the weakest performance since John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon started the tradition of televised debates in 1960, then as on Thursday in a television studio with no audience. Minutes into the showdown hosted by CNN, a full-blown Democratic panic was underway at the idea of heading into an election with such a diminished figure at the top of the ticket. Biden, shall we say, was not particularly energetic on the stage. He mumbled a lot of answers. He seemed to get a bit confused at points. He kind of trailed off. He wasn't really able to properly defend a lot of his points. And yeah, as a lot of American voters have expressed, they were concerned that Joe Biden was simply too old and too unenergetic for the job. And there's been a very, very long-running, hard-fought campaign by the Democrats to try and push back against this perceptions to suggest that Joe Biden is actually pretty energetic, particularly behind the scenes, and he's just a bit of a wacky old man. But last night, that seems to have all collapsed. And I think that unless the Democrats get rid of him, they're probably doomed in November when the election is held. Now, who knows? You know, I don't think Trump gave a particularly amazing performance last night from what I can tell of it. But that doesn't really matter if people think that your opponent just quite simply can't do the job. Chris, let me start with you. Do you agree with the way I've just laid out the whole campaign? And do you think there's any chance that Joe Biden will be replaced by the Democratic Party? They don't have long to do it. Their conference to where they will nominate him officially is in 2 months, and they don't have time to hold primaries.
So on the question of replacing Biden, possibly, I think it's too close to the election. There is still time, but if you look at the other possibilities, I mean, Kamala Harris doesn't have, if you talk about popularity, I don't think that word should be used in her.
One popular than Joe Biden and Donald Trump, who are both already unpopular themselves.
Yeah. If you listen to some of Biden's surrogates, people like Gavin Newsom, voters who would listen to people like that, and undecided voters, they would ask, why isn't someone like that put on in this particular why, and they're at the top of the ticket. So that's going to raise questions around Democrat strategy going forward, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if they're going to break the glass on going for the replacing Biden. There's an issue now where it's not about facts or ideology or policies. It's just about vibes. It's just about impressions. And between the two of them, Biden gave the worst impression yesterday. I mean, both were meandering. When asked about his environmental policy, Trump said, I want absolutely immaculately clean water. I want clean air. And we had it. We had H2O. We had the best numbers ever. So if it's a competition between coherence, and factualness, it's not that's what it boils down to. So
there's a point where they argued about who was the better golfer. And you should
yes. Exactly.
Something has gone very wrong. As far as I understand it, from listening to podcasts and discussions of this by American political insiders, everyone in the Democratic Party is really scared of fighting with Joe Biden and either that causing them to lose Biden to lose the election, or replacing him and then failing to win the election themselves, because then their career will be destroyed because the Democrats will never forgive whoever returns Trump to the White House. So there's kind of this sort of, I don't know, collective action problem where almost every single Democratic leader appears to be who could potentially replace Biden is kind of just sitting on the sidelines and going, I'm not going to take the risk. I'm not going to put myself out there. We'll just let him take the flak. And if he goes down, it's not my problem. But after last night's performance, Sarah, do you think that will hold?
Well, it's a moment of ultimate schadenfreude for the Democratic Party, because they've worked so hard to pretend that what we have seen isn't the reality, that Biden, you know, it's a sort of the mask of the sort of bumbling older man who's just, you know, being a bit idiosyncratic. I mean, for CNN hosted this, and CNN political analyst slated the result. And it's you know, the problem is, when whatever this Biden situation was, you know, Trump, it kind of almost doesn't matter what he says. He's Trump. You know, if he avoids things or contradicts himself or says something weird, you know, it's another day since 2016. You know, what makes it different? But they were banking desperately, and, you know, they should have known better than all of us what Biden's health and mental acuity is. And they called for the debate and they took the chance, and it just collapsed in front of them. It just absolutely collapsed. I mean, so literally, Trump could have said nothing but try and do a handstand virtually. And can you imagine what that would have gone down? The bar was
funny, actually.
But Biden, as a younger, fitter person, would probably have come at well 10 years ago, but certainly not now. And it's that sort of reckoning where both parties have a huge amount of introspection to do. And it's probably, if it's going to happen at all, it's probably too late for this election. It'll have to happen afterwards.
So I think when people look back on the Biden administration, I think one of the biggest issues that will be highlighted was his choosing of Kamala Harris as his vice presidential pick, because, you know, she was pretty weak within the Democratic primary. She dropped out relatively early. She never polled that high. I think she polled sort of like 5% or something within the Democratic primary. So she wasn't exactly, it wasn't exactly unifying the party to bring her in, because she wasn't even popular in the Democratic Party. She also turned out to be a very untalented politician, one who was basically only able to sell herself in California, her home state, outside of which she really hasn't been able to fly on the national political stage. And when your candidate is really old and people have questions about their health, they're going to look a lot at the vice president and say, okay, well, you know, maybe Joe is a bit past it, but like, if he goes, retires, dies, whatever, are we going to get someone who we can live with as a replacement? And as long as that replacement was Kamala Harris, I think it really, really did hurt his campaign and his election chances, because there is no backup. I think Biden would be in a much stronger position if he had chosen a much more moderate, much more sort of centrist, more talented vice presidential candidate. But I also think there was probably a little bit of fear in the Biden administration. He didn't want to pick anyone too talented who might upstage him. Chris, any final thoughts?
It'll be interesting, I guess, how it shakes out now. When also keep in mind longer-term trends. So regardless of who the president is, both parties are strong on industrial policy, subsidies for quote-unquote local manufacturing, raising more barriers to free trade, ramping up that spending, government spending. So the U.S.'s forward trajectory doesn't necessarily put it in a strong economic position, regardless of who the president turns out to be.
Yeah, there's actually a surprising amount on a lot of domestic policy, of particularly economic stuff, of convergence between the two candidates, which is quite interesting. Trump may promise some other kind of tax cut, which Biden won't, but you know, even that will be probably relatively limited in its scope, just because you know, there's been a lot of tax cuts over the past 20, 30 years in American politics, and the number of places to cut taxes, at least at the federal level, is not what it once was. All right. Anyway, I think that's all the time we have for today. I don't know, Sarah, do you have any final thoughts before we close?
Well, I think the other problem for Biden is the fact that the economy actually matters to ordinary Americans. And although the economy is doing better, inflation went up at one point, prices went up, they never came down. And that's the lived experience of most Americans.
Yeah, if there's a thing that's going to devastate your political campaign, it's always going to be inflation. Inflation is one of the most unpopular and disastrous things you can possibly have happen to you. And economists will debate as to how much it was Biden's fault. There are arguments on both sides on that one that I think are reasonable. But at the end of the day, there's inflation during your term. You're going to be fighting an uphill battle. And that has definitely been the case so far. Anyway, we'll see. You know, American politics recently has produced such wacky and weird things that who knows, maybe, I don't know, Trump will turn into a giant bat or something and then the Republicans will pick someone new. Who knows? But I think that on the current trajectory, it's pretty clear what's going to happen in November. So something will need to drastically change. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. We look forward to hopefully on Monday sharing a little bit more idea of what the South African cabinet is going to look like. And until next time, I hope you all have a wonderful weekend. Cheers, everyone.